family, and I'm a registered member of the Manitoba Métis Federation, you know, so that just helps me to feel grounded more in where I'm from and who I am. And I mean, out here in British Columbia, and I'm on stage still a lot introducing concerts, and it's very normal here. And back home in Métis circles, it's very common that you have to say who you are, where you're from, who your family is, you know, what your territory is, what your job is, all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where I am in learning and being able to express who I am and where I'm from.
Have any of your kids been interested in learning or?
Well, I think my kids are both musicians, and my son is in Montreal, so it's pretty hard for him there because they don't even really want to know about Métis, right? For them, we're Francophones, we're French, and that's been one of those challenges, even getting recognition of the fact that there are Métis. He has a sash. Like, we do have some of our cultural things that, and he just recorded a piece of mine called Red River, a cello sonata that should be out soon. And so he's premiered and commissioned works by me and by other Métis composers. Our daughter is out here, and so she's actually become a little more interested in traditional Métis fiddling because she's a violinist. So I think her energy is more spent trying to learn some jigs.
I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, no, my pleasure.
That was my conversation with composer, teacher, and former CBC radio personality, Pat Carabre, who grew up in Manitoba and currently lives in Vancouver, BC. This has been the RVF Franco Podcast 2026. Thanks for tuning in.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. This is a Sichuan news update. Bluebirds could have once been seen and heard all across the Cowichan Valley. But the loss of habitat due to development saw a decline so significant that bluebirds became locally extinct. Cowichan Valley conservationists, seeing the devastating loss of bluebirds in the area, started the Bring Back the Bluebirds project. The project, started in 2012, seeks to reintroduce a flourishing population of bluebirds, while also fostering the stewardship of Garry Oak ecosystems. Jackie Taylor is the project coordinator for the BC Conservation Foundation, who oversees the Cowichan Bring Back the Birds project.
So they were so common that the local newspaper had an article, this is in the 50s, I believe, saying, "We know it's spring because the bluebirds are everywhere." Right. So that was how common they were at that time. And they were all through southern Vancouver Island in Victoria and the Gulf Islands as well. And the populations all along the coast had pummeled through the 70s and into the 90s as people developed the Garry Oak habitats and the nesting cavities that they relied on were lost.
The Western bluebird is the only species of bluebird found on Vancouver Island and the Gulf Islands. Male bluebirds can be identified by their bright blue color and orange chest, while females have a more gray coloration, with blue highlights throughout their body and a peachy-colored breast. Taylor says the Western bluebird was once labeled as extirpated, meaning the species was locally extinct to the Vancouver Island and Gulf Island area, while the rest of the population in North America was doing fine.
They rely on cavity nesting holes that are built by woodpeckers in oaks here. They can also go in pine trees and other places, but they can't build their own holes. And so when people are taking down the old oaks to build homes and buildings, they lost their cavity nesting holes. And so they had nowhere to nest, and so their population just dwindled until it was gone.
The project is focused near Quamichin and Somnus Lake in the Cowichan Valley and uses a conservation area that is not open to the public for their work. Taylor says their work is to build a secure population of bluebirds in the area.
So secure looks like we have enough birds returning each year on their own that even if a few birds are lost or predated on or there's a bad season, the population will recover itself. Right now, what happens is if we actually, we had brought the numbers up, we stopped translocations and the population crashed again. Mm. And so we want to see some resilience in the population. We want to see the return rates high enough that it will grow itself.
She says this work can be done due to very early conservation of the biodiverse Gary Oak ecosystems. These ecosystems are where Gary Oak trees naturally occurred before European settlement. CHY joined Taylor in the field visiting the conservation site to look for early signs of bluebirds.
Do bluebirds have a very distinctive call?
Yes.
Because they sort of like sing.
They do, but this, what I tend to hear more right now is their contact call, which sounds like a little pew, pew. Like.
Since 2012, the project has been translocating pairs and families of bluebirds from Washington State to grow the local population. The project also supports the population by supplementing nesting cavities with wooden nest boxes and using supplementary food sources to make sure the birds are receiving enough food.
This is a feeder made by one of our volunteers. So this mesh is the right size for a bluebird to fit in, but too small for starlings. And so we give them daily rations of mealworms. And the reason is, I mean, there is enough food to support them here, but but having that little bit of extra makes it more likely that they'll have two clutches in a season instead of just one.
And the clutches is like the eggs.
Yeah, so they'll lay usually about 5 or 6 eggs, and then they'll raise those young until they fledge, and then if they have enough energy and they're all doing well, then they'll have a second clutch of eggs, which they'll raise.
She says they have about 15 volunteers who monitor the local population. Along with monitoring the area, Taylor says volunteers do a lot of work building nest boxes and bird feeders, and even growing the mealworms that are used for supplementary feeding.
We keep track on data sheets so that we can share the data with Project Nest Watch and then other researchers who want to know about how songbirds are doing, then they can use that information too. It also helps us. It helps us to learn more about the safety of the boxes and how the birds are doing. So, you know, if we notice that in one spot, you know, the adults keep showing up dead in that box, then we can sort of go, okay, something's wrong with that location. And often what it is a house sparrow has taken over that area and is fighting for the boxes. So, you know, that gives us information so we can decide, okay, so is that place where we should just remove that box, or we can put little hole reducers so that it's only available to small birds like chickadees and wrens. The cavities that the swallows and the bluebirds would have been using are created by woodpeckers. They can't build their own cavities. Oh. So they just have to rely on what cavities are available. And because we have taken down so many of the old oaks that would have had those cavities, there just isn't very many available.
Okay.
So they do very well in boxes, which is the good news. And it's worked to recover populations in lots of other places, which is, you know, for example, Ontario, this was the eastern bluebird. The species had been, I'm distracted by this hawk. I'm guessing we're not going to see a bluebird now.
Do bluebirds hear that noise and just instantly hide?
Yeah. So, woodpeckers will build a new cavity every year. Mm-hmm. But because it's part of their, you know, attract a mate behavior. But And then the holes are available to other creatures. But it has to be, you know, the big old trees have to be available for that. But it is, I mean, the good news about that is, yeah, using boxes has worked well to recover populations in areas where they lost their cavity nesting trees. They'll be going around right now, the pairs, and just investigating all of the different boxes. And it's funny, actually, this time of year, it's kind of fun to watch because you'll see them. It's like they're having a bit of a couples argument. You'll see the male sitting on one box, and the female are like, but what about this one?
Taylor says they tend to see bluebirds returning in March, and by April, most of the birds will have established themselves. She says they stay for the summertime before they migrate down to Mexico in August.
So the funny thing is they normally migrate, but we've had quite a few actually stay this winter.
Oh, yeah. Is that normal? Is that like a concern?
It's not a concern. I think there were so many because it was mild, but it's not uncommon when there's a bunch of bluebirds living in an area for a few to stick around. That would be pretty normal. It's just the numbers was quite high.
During the interview, Taylor says in recent years, they have been seeing bluebirds visit the south coast of Vancouver Island. While bluebirds are not yet resting in the Victoria area, she says this is a very encouraging sign for the local population. While Taylor says there's not one target number for the population they're working towards, Taylor says they want to get the population secure to the point where the birds can sustain themselves.
We still need to maintain the boxes. That's kind of a forever thing. And we might need to support them with mealworms sometimes to, you know, get them through bad years. But we're hoping that we can get them a little bit more self-sustaining.
With conservation efforts underway for the last 14 years, the project received good news last year, seeing the highest number of bluebirds in the area since the 1980s. The second highest population count was in 2015, with 29 total birds counting adults and young.
Last year we had about 20 adults, and over the course of the year they added 72 young. Now, the first year of every species' life is a very risky one, and so we'll only see some of those come back, but it's great to see the population growing.
As bluebirds start to return to the Cowichan Valley, the Bring Back the Bluebirds project is hosting a workshop for people interested in volunteering.
We're going to have a workshop. We're going to train everybody on how to identify different nests and different birds that use the boxes. Then I'll set everybody out on their way with their equipment, and they'll go and check on all the nest boxes and see who's in there. And they'll keep checking those every week to see what's going on. They'll let me know if there's bluebirds, and if we find bluebirds, then we'll start supporting them with daily feedings of mealworms.
People interested in volunteering can email couchandbluebird@gmail.com. Taylor says people can also email her if they believe they spotted a bluebird. This helps the project keep track of the birds to support them. The project also has an Adopt a Nest program, where by donation, supporters can adopt a nest, receiving updates and photos of the bluebird family who nests there over the season. As the population continues to grow, Taylor says she's excited to see what will come next for the songbird population in the Cowichan Valley. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hello, I'm Madeline Taylor. You're listening to a documentary produced for CJSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. This is I Am a Fruit Tree.
This is my island in the sun, where my people have toiled since time begun. I may sail on many a sea, her shores will always be home to me.
Simon Fraser University has a bit of a reputation. It's known to be dark, the architecture is often compared to a prison, and everyone complains about the commute. Because we all commute, it's hard to make friends on the mountain. As a student, it's easy to let this stereotype dictate your experience. We fall into the tyranny of the urgent. It's tempting to plug in, power through, and ignore the world around you. Thankfully, there are characters at SFU who break this mold every day.
I'm Shiraz Ramji. I was born in Tanzania, East Africa, on 10th December 1948. At present, I'm 66-year-old. That is about 24,000 days, because I love to count my age in days, and I can celebrate my birthday every day. I'm an educator. I'm trained as a teacher and also as a gerontologist, and I call myself a justice-friendly pacifist.
Shiraz is very well known at SFU for a few different reasons. He has lectured, worked, and studied all over campus since 1994. I first met Shiraz when I was a student. He was standing in a main concourse with a smile, giving out copies of his poetry. He wears sports clothes emblazoned with SFU logos and walks like he's late for something. What is striking about him is his lack of pretense. He doesn't expect anything from you when he offers his poetry. It's simply an open invitation to engage. I found this so unusual and couldn't quite figure out what his motivation was. As it turns out, Shiraz is a peace activist. He told me he's been writing poetry since he was a young boy. He calls it part of his activism and uses poetry to start conversations and spread his message of justice-friendly peace.
It was mostly grade 5 or 6 somewhere where the teacher said, "You speak like a poet." I didn't know what he meant, but he says, write whatever you're speaking. And he would read it and he said, "This is poetry and you should write it all the time." One day I realized the price of photocopy at my student union was 4 cents. So I said, "Oh, I can afford that." So I said, "Okay, I'll spend $2 every day for my poetry." So I started printing them. And then I started sharing them. That was about 12 years ago.
Shiraz doesn't only do this at SFU. He approaches people in every part of his daily life.
That's always a challenge, whom I should ask. But sometimes it can be like this morning. There was a woman on the SkyTrain. She was reading about elementary educators. So I said, "Oh, I am an educator." So I asked her, "Do you read poetry and where do you study?" And I said, "I write poetry." So I gave her one. So it depends. If I know, like SFU students, is very easy. So I just tell them, "I write poetry. Do you read poetry?" And then they say yes. So I said, "Take one." And if they don't want it, then I say, "Thank you. Okay, next." But even if I didn't have poetry, I would just talk to people. So that has always been my lifestyle.
Back at SFU, Shiraz took me around to some of his favorite parts of campus. On this little walking tour, I discovered that homemade hummus is another tool he uses to connect.
Hi, here she is. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, Shiraz.
How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Yeah.
Well, it's so nice to see you.
Nice. I'm thinking of your ice cream all the time.
Oh, I love it.
So my name is Sarah Manassian, and I'm the fitness programmer at SFU Recreation. When I think of Shiraz, I just think of this warm, smiling guy. He would come into the fitness center, and he'd always bring us pita and homemade hummus. And it was staffs, like, would get excited about, like, "Oh, it's Sunday, Shiraz is coming in. He's going to bring his, like, pita and homemade hummus." And we just loved that. That's probably one of my fondest memories, because it happened every weekend, like, without stop. And I think that kind of made our fitness center more of a community, too, because people would actually come in on the weekends because they knew Shiraz was going to come to bring pita and hummus, and they'd come in on the weekends, so we'd all sit around and eat the hummus that Shiraz would bring.
He got this reaction constantly. What I wanted to know was what in his life led Shiraz to be so open with his community. After getting to know him better, I started to understand the root of his activism.
Well, you see, when I grew up in Tanzania, I was born in 1948, so I started schooling in 1954. And So it was still part of British colony, and so you see all the racism and segregation of all the different racial groups and so on. So you knew what was colonialism, what is dictatorship, and you hear about all the wars and stuff like that. There were schools which were for European settlers, and then there were Asian schools, and there were African schools. Yeah, like even the buses, they had segregated place. You had to, like, you got the movies, you had to stand up because you had to sing the God Save the King and stuff like that. So we all knew that, and the whole glorification of Britain, how good it is. And it was legally that way, but it... So some people assimilated with the whole thing and accepted their second-class status. I wasn't very keen on that, so it was there all the time.
Tanzania achieved independence from British colonial rule in 1961. To the south, Mozambique was under Portuguese colonial rule. They endured a decade of anti-colonial struggle, followed by a civil war through the 1970s and 80s. In the 1970s, Shiraz taught in Tanzania. There, he supported the African Liberation Movement and its activists.
It was part of the anti-colonial struggle in Tanzania itself. We were quite influenced by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Angela Davis. So it was at a global level as well as local level, there was the whole issue of anti-apartheid.
These experiences of colonial violence, segregation, and oppression have made Shiraz very aware of the dangers of focusing on difference.
I mean, I met a lot of the present and the past leaders of South Africa or Mozambique and so on. So they would come to our school and give a talk. So it has been very much part of my struggle, yeah.
By the early 1990s, after decades of working in education, in medical research, in public health, and in refugee advocacy in East Africa, Shiraz was looking for a change. Both of his parents had passed away, and his partner was killed in a bicycle accident while studying in London.
Well, I was in Africa at that time, and she was finishing her master's in nutrition. And that's when it happened. So we were studying together at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So I got the news from family and so on of that happened, because she was going to join me. So that was quite tragic. But then I didn't know what to tell people because I moved from Tanzania to Zimbabwe. So they didn't know her, right? So it was very hard to tell people. So that was on time when I was on my own. At that level, I'm more of a private person. Like, I wouldn't talk much about these things, generally, unless people ask me. So when it came to 94, my mission was at least to be involved with anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, and then independence came in April 94. Mother had passed, my father had also passed in Africa. After the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa was become more independent struggles, right, I wanted a break. And my sister was very ill, so I came to Canada.
Shiraz's transition to Canada was eased by his entry into community life at SFU. A student and an educator for his whole life, he was comfortable at school.
So here is our library. So this is what I call the holy place, the holy land, SFU holy land. It's for everybody.
Shiraz talks a lot about globalizing friendship and how this can be done through sharing food with your community. Food was a central theme in all of the conversations I had with Shiraz. This is Celeste. She taught Shiraz when he took a movement class at SFU.
There is an unforgettable story. Every student in the class is required to teach the rest of the class a dance. It could be a circle dance, a folk dance, but they have to make it up from scratch. Shiraz taught us a dance called the hummus dance. It was like a group dance around food globalization, and we danced the hummus, we made the hummus through dance. The joy that he brought to this piece and the love that he brought to this piece was so truly moving.
Shiraz doesn't believe in the idea of strangers. He thinks it allows for fear and separation.
Because I don't have many family members, so I just interact with people as if they are part of the family. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going in the morning exercise, I'm feeling I'm with the community. And so it's a way to break the barrier of being lonely or isolated.
to be honest, I don't know what the words are for it. I feel a feeling when I think of Shiraz. I think maybe the thing that's different about him is he'll engage anybody and everybody. He's just so welcoming. He's so open. He'll come up, he'll give you a hug, he'll speak smiles. Have you read my poetry lately? Here's what's going on. Do you want some hummus? I'm going to bring you some food. Like, it's every time that you see him.
As I said, I always want to know, first to create that community and make people not be afraid of me or anybody else. But also to hear stories of people in terms of not necessarily private stories, but how do they look at life and how do they respond to people like me. So it gives me a feeling that there are many people who want to create that community, but somebody has to start. Almost every case, I'm the one who starts, and then the ball starts rolling.
I love the sense of his deep curiosity for life. To me, that's what SFU was all about. Now I look around at SFU and I see them all. They look absolutely, everyone looks bored to death. You get Shiraz walking through here. He just has a love of life. And you know, it doesn't even need a cell phone.
So it turns out that Shiraz isn't well known at SFU because of his longevity. It's because he reminds people of what they really want from campus. Community and a sense of belonging.
SFU is a happy place, and it's also a place with some challenges. Happiness in a sense, there's a diversity of people. It can be sadness because the education system, so a lot of education is very Eurocentric. And there are a lot of slogans like critical learning or critical thinking, but essentially it's more conformist education. So it can be challenging for you. I normally consider every person is a fruit tree, so I said just enjoy the fruit.
Why a fruit tree?
Well, I was surrounded. I grew up with so many fruit trees. Papayas grow in 9 months. I used to plant a lot of fruit trees. And I think it's a universal food. There's no recipe for fruit trees. It's just fruit. So I thought as a global citizen, it fits in my narrative.
What does community mean to you?
Community is like what I call the fruit salad, right? Where you have a mixture of everybody around. So it's much of a collective experience. I mean, there are collective experience in SFU, for example. It's a community, right?
His outlook is contagious. But here's the thing. What is a community? A community is a group of people with something in common, but it's often described as a sense. You feel a sense of community. It's not something that geographic locations just have on their own. Shiraz's approach is to make every space into a community.
I believe we all have the capacity to touch into something that is invisible, that is greater than us, on however you articulate it. But it is a love that infuses far beyond the imagination and far beyond our daily living, because our daily living is fraught with so many difficulties. And I think Shiraz has probably had experiences enough to have to empty himself, where he then is tapped into this greater source of love. And I'm not going to articulate certain labels around that, but I believe he embodies love.
I tell people, I believe that I'm not the only Shiraz in the world. There are many people Shiraz in the world. And, for example, I can relate to you because I see Shiraz in you and you see yourself in me, right? So don't assume you're alone.
His poetry is not only in print, it's the impression he leaves on people. His embodiment of the fruit tree allows him to connect and create openness and curiosity in the people he meets. He makes eye contact, simple conversation, and impacts SFU by building community through the simple act of constant and unapologetic engagement.
That's what I tell people. Take your path. If you need help, come and have a tea with me.
Well, on that note, can you share a poem or two with us?
Yeah, okay. I'll share with you the one, my favorite one, which is my autobiography of as a child. It's called Via Mother Earth. I'm a fruit tree. I'm a fruitful tree. I'm a banana tree. I grow bananas shaped like human lips to share and tell stories with my global friends. I'm a cherry tree. I grow cherries shaped like human eyes.
This documentary was produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I would also like to thank Shiraz Ramji, Celeste Snober, Sarah Manassian, and Victoria Haraway for their voices and stories.
her shores will always be home to me.